Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. I have a little cold this week, so just bear with me. This week, we'll speak with Randall Eliason. He's a former assistant U.S. attorney who now teaches law at George Washington University. And we'll speak to him about the potential criminal violations in play if it is shown that the Trump campaign, in fact, colluded with the Russians, which I have to say is looking ever more likely. And a spoiler alert, contrary to what you might have heard in the conservative media, it is all kinds of illegal to conspire with a hostile foreign government. It's even illegal to conspire with a friendly foreign government or a non-governmental actor to undermine a U.S. election. And I feel like that should be obvious, but for some reason it's not. No, you can't just cheat in an election so blatantly, at least. Then we'll be joined by Jill Filipovic to discuss her new book, The H-Spot, The Feminist Pursuit of Happiness. First, a few items you may have missed. Trump has been in office for 176 days. Seems a lot longer than that. Seems like it's been 176 years. He has spent 53 of those days at Trump properties. And that's even more impressive when you consider that he's taken three foreign trips during which he didn't visit any of his hotels. Last week, Anita Kumar reported for Bloomberg that, quote, even as he serves as president, Donald Trump earns a tidy sum, tens to hundreds of thousands, every time a new member joins one of his Tony clubs. Kumar adds that Trump has benefited greatly from these initiation fees for years. Soon after his election, the Trump organization doubled the membership fees at Mar-a-Lago. Basically, he just pockets those fees personally. And while all eyes have been on the White House's Voter Suppression Commission, as well as moves made by the Department of Justice under Jeff Sessions, eight states have, quote, passed or are implementing laws with more rigorous voter identification requirements this year, according to NBC's Jane Timm. She writes, fueled by President Donald Trump, who has claimed without evidence that voter fraud deprived him of the popular vote, there's more energy behind election legislation at the state level than ever before. Speaking of Trump's ridiculous commission, Democrats are worried about the fact that 3,000 Coloradoans, unregistered because they feared that their information was being shared with the Trump regime. Yes, this is a tiny share of the overall electorate, but come on, people, don't let these bastards win that easily. You know, instead of withdrawing your registration, you should go out and get like three other people to register to vote. Mark Landler, Eric Schmidt, and Michael Gordon report for the New York Times that, quote, Trump's advisors recruited two businessmen who profited from military contracting to devise alternatives to the Pentagon's plan to send additional troops to Afghanistan. According to the report, Stephen Bannon and Jared Kushner sought proposals from Eric Prince, the Prince of Darkness, the founder of Blackwater Worldwide, and Steven Feinberg, a billionaire financier who owns the giant military contractor DynCorp International. And they asked them to, quote, develop proposals to rely on contractors instead of American troops in Afghanistan, which has worked out so very well in the past. A new Pew study released this week found widespread dissatisfaction with American institutions. But one finding jumped out, according to Pew, and I quote, a majority of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents now say that colleges and universities have a negative effect on the country. 58%, 6 in 10, say that colleges and universities have a negative effect on the country. This is the Know-Nothing Party. This is the result, the culmination of decades of attacking any kind of neutral source of information, the media, the academy, science. You end up with a bunch of dummies who think that being educated is a bad thing. One former White House official describes the public harassment of civil servants by the current White House or its allies as unprecedented. Foreign Policy's Kate Brennan, Dan DeLuce, and Jenna McLaughlin report, and I quote, career civil servants often endure stressful working conditions, but in the Trump White House, some of them face online trolling from alt-right bloggers who seek to portray them as clandestine partisans plotting to sabotage the president's agenda. The online attacks that they endure often cite information that appears to be provided by unnamed White House officials or Trump loyalists. Some have received threats of violence. This is not okay. You know how we fancy ourselves a nation of immigrants. So most people who are hostile toward immigrants for cultural or ideological reasons, or because they're just bigots, claim that they welcome those who come here illegally and only are bothered by the undocumented. So you get into debates with them and they'll say, what part of illegal don't you understand? Well, Donald Trump is bringing clarity to this issue. Eliana Johnson and Josh Dossi reported for Politico this week that, quote, Trump and his aides are quietly working with two conservative senators to dramatically scale back legal immigration, a move that would mark a fulfillment of one of the president's biggest campaign promises. Now, I don't remember him promising. Didn't he say he loved immigrants and it was all about the rule of law? I don't remember the decrease in legal immigration being one of his biggest campaign promises. At the root, Breonna Edwards tells how a 5'2" black woman with cornrows was, quote, confronted by police at gunpoint, punched in the mouth, and bitten by a police dog after police in Bakersfield, California, apparently mistook her for a much larger, bald, black man with a goatee. The 19-year-old woman... Officer Christopher Moore wrote in a report that the 19-year-old woman appeared to be a male and matched the description of the suspect. After the violent confrontation, of course, the teen was arrested on suspicion of resisting or delaying an officer and aggravated assault on an officer. So they brutalized her and then arrested her for, I guess, hitting their knuckles with her face. Anyway, on that sunny note, we'll take a quick break and come right back. Stay tuned.
Thank you. lusting and his hunger for power became known to more and more people, the demands to do something about this outrageous man became louder and louder.
Lyndon Johnson said that when he lost Walter Cronkite on Vietnam, he lost the country. A lot has changed since then, but check out this unusual for Fox News exchange between Shep Smith and Chris Wallace.
Yeah, I think, you know, this really shouldn't be a matter of liberal versus conservative, pro-Trump versus anti-Trump. If you're a fair-minded citizen, you ought to be concerned about the fact that we were repeatedly misled about what this meeting concerned. I had Reince Priebus, the White House chief of staff, on this program at this desk a week ago last Sunday, and he said this was a meeting about adoption. That was the story at that point. That was the story that had been approved by the White House at this point. I don't know whether Reince, who's a good fellow, knew anything more about it or not. But that wasn't what the meeting was about, because as we learned later that day, after all the Sunday shows were over, from the New York Times, not from anybody in the Trump world, that this was a meeting to try to get dirt about Hillary Clinton. And then we learned on Tuesday, as I say in black and white from those emails, well, in fact, this was supposed to be, and what the Trump folks took the meeting to accomplish was the Russian government trying to give information about Hillary Clinton as part of an effort to swing the election to Donald Trump. So, you know, you're exactly right. We've been told a variety of stories. We've gotten, and who knows if we've gotten to the end of the story. We thought we got to the end of the story with the emails.
I know we haven't, because there's news breaking at this moment, Chris.
Okay.
Fox News can now confirm more. Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, the lawyer from Russia, the interpreter, this new guy we found out about today, and a mystery person. John Roberts confirms there was an eighth person in that meeting. We don't know. There may have been more, but there was an eighth. Jared Kushner filled out his form, I think it's an F-86, saying who he'd met with and what he'd done. Very important stuff. You can go to prison for messing it up. You know, intentionally. He went back and added 100 names and places. None of these people made it. They're still not clean. We're still not clean on this, Chris. If there's nothing there, and that's what they tell us. They tell us there's nothing to this and nothing came of it. There's a nothing burger. It wasn't even memorable. Didn't write it down. Didn't tell you about it because it wasn't anything. So I didn't even remember it with a Russian interpreter in the room at Trump Tower. If all of that, why all these lies? Why is it lie after lie after lie? If you clean, come on, clean. You know, my grandmother used to say, when first we practice to, oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. The deception, Chris, is mind-boggling. And there are still people out there who believe we're making it up. And one day they're going to realize we're not and look around and go, where are we and why are we getting told all these lies?
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. It has been difficult at times to keep up with the Kremlin Gate reporting. In the past month or so, we've seen some tantalizing suggestions of actual collusion between the Trump campaign and various Russian operatives with ties to the Kremlin. And it began with Shane Goldmacher reporting for the Wall Street Journal that a veteran GOP donor, an activist named Peter Smith, was trying to find some hackers who could get their hands on Hillary Clinton's emails. He at least presented himself to people as working with then senior campaign advisor Michael Flynn. By the way, I should say it was reported this week that Smith committed suicide shortly after speaking with the Wall Street Journal. If you're into conspiracy theories, you can have at that one. I don't indulge in them myself. The White House issued an odd denial about that one. They said, well, it's not true, but if it is true, then Flynn was operating as a private citizen, which is funny because he was, again, attached to the campaign. Then came the New York Times report starting last Saturday about Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and former campaign manager Paul Manafort, who himself has ties to these pro-Russia parties in Ukraine, meeting with this lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya, after Jr. was promised that the Russian government, in its bid to help the campaign, had some dirt it could offer on Hillary Clinton. Then on Friday, we learned that another person attended the meeting, ABC News described him as, and I will quote, a Russian-American lobbyist who is also a former Soviet counterintelligence officer who is suspected by some U.S. officials of having ongoing ties to Russian intelligence. I mean, it just goes on and on. And then finally, McClatchy reported, and I quote, that investigators are examining whether the Trump campaign's digital operation, overseen by Jared Kushner, helped guide Russia's sophisticated voter dart targeting and fake news attacks on Hillary Clinton in 2016. The sleuths, I guess you could say, are focusing, quote, on whether Trump's campaign pointed Russian cyber operatives to certain voting jurisdictions in key states, areas where Trump's digital team and Republican operatives were spotting unexpected weakness in voter support for Hillary Clinton. Okay, so now we're up to speed, and amid all of this, the meat puppets on Fox News have been saying, well, even if there's collusion here, there's nothing wrong with that. And the mainstream commentary has focused really relentlessly on whether this might have violated campaign finance laws. Now, fortunately, my next guest, who has suffered through an unusually long introduction, has written a terrific piece at Sidebar's blog about the real legal issues at play here. Randall Eliason knows what he's talking about. He was an assistant U.S. attorney, and he currently teaches law at Georgetown University. His piece is titled, Yes, Colluding with Russians to Interfere with the Election is a Crime. Professor Eliason, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Let me make one minor correction. George Washington University, not Georgetown University.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. My apologies. George Washington University. So it seems from your piece that it's eight different kinds of illegal to conspire with a foreign actor to undermine a U.S. election. Let's take it one step at a time. And of course, where that is, if it is proven that that's what happened. Let's take it one step at a time. You write that the most likely crime here was criminal conspiracy. What does that entail?
Sure. So all the talk about collusion that we've been hearing, collusion is not really a criminal law term, but conspiracy is, and embodies the same kind of idea, basically an agreement to commit some kind of wrongful act. So in criminal law terms, when we talk about conspiracy, we talk about two or more people agreeing either to commit a crime, to commit a different federal crime, or to defraud the United States. So they're kind of two different ways you can violate the statute. And then the thing about conspiracy, of course, is you don't actually have to succeed. So conspiracy is a separate crime. You can conspire to rob a bank or conspire to engage in a Ponzi scheme or whatever, and even if for some reason you don't succeed or it falls through, the agreement itself to commit that crime, and as long as you take some steps, you enter that agreement knowing what you're doing with the criminal intent and you take some steps to try to carry it out, that alone can be a separate crime as well.
Now, let me ask you this. We probably don't have prima facie evidence of that crime already, but if there was more to the meeting than what we have been told by Donald Trump Jr. and the campaign, let us say that they did, in fact, deliver some kind of dirt on Hillary Clinton that was obtained by the Russian government as part of its active measures thing, would that already be a crime even if they didn't use that information?
Well, potentially yes. Whether they use it or not doesn't necessarily matter if there's an agreement, like I said, to commit the offense or to try to interfere in the election. But it's important to emphasize, as you mentioned, that we really don't know a whole lot yet, right? We're seeing kind of things dribbling out through the media. And this is a single email in what's a really long and I'm sure very complicated investigation and sort of series of events. And so we'd really need to know a whole lot more before we know whether the conduct here actually amounted to a crime versus just something less.
Are you at all surprised that former FBI Director Robert Mueller reportedly learned of this meeting only through the media? Just given the scope of U.S. intelligence of Russian operatives and how extensive his team is, does that surprise you at all?
Not necessarily. I mean, first, I guess we don't know for certain that that's right. That's just another media report. But
right.
Given the scope of the investigation, I'm sure they are taking in huge amounts of information, emails, phone records, text messages, all kinds of things from all different sources, and it takes time to get all that information in and then to review it all. So it's certainly possible that they hadn't come across it yet. So, you know, it wouldn't shock me, but it's certainly a pretty important piece of information. If they hadn't focused on it before, I'm sure they're focused on it now.
Yeah, they are, according to reports. Now, let's say the Trump team, and again, this is a hypothetical, let's say they gave them some information on certain voters that they were targeting in some districts, and then they stepped back and the Trump campaign didn't do anything. They weren't actively involved, but the Russians then flooded those districts with a wave of fake news and disinformation. Again, without Trump campaign any direct involvement, they just said, well, look, these are the districts that our analytics have suggested are soft Clinton districts. What do you think that looks like legally?
Well, there are a couple different possibilities there. Again, sort of depending on how involved Trump people were, if that happened, that's another possible conspiracy charge. Even if the Russians actually are the ones that carry out all the interference with the election, if there are Trump officials who agree to cooperate in that, then theoretically you've got a conspiracy to defraud the U.S. by interfering with the election, and that's a separate crime from the actual interference itself. So even if all the Russians did all of that, the conspiracy charge could still be there. Or conspiracy to violate federal campaign laws if that work or that research was considered a contribution to the Trump campaign. That's illegal. It's illegal for a foreign national to contribute to a U.S. campaign. So if they helped that happen, that's another possible conspiracy to commit that offense. And there are also things like sort of accessory after the fact, you know, where you learn about a crime after it's already happened, and then you help the perpetrator conceal it or avoid being caught, things like that. You know, so there are other possible offenses involved where if the Trump campaign knows that this illegal hacking has taken place and that the Russians are doing it and trying to influence the election, and they don't do anything about it, they don't report it to anybody, and in fact they maybe help the Russians try to conceal that fact, those are other possible separate offenses there as well. So,
and you mentioned a conspiracy or the potential charge of a conspiracy to defraud the U.S. government. Usually I think of defrauding the U.S. government as like, you know, like a Medicaid scam or something that has a tangible value. Does it go beyond that?
Yeah, that's a good point. Typically, you're right. Fraud usually means to deprive someone of money or property. So defraud the U.S. would be like a healthcare fraud scheme or something where we're stealing money from the government. But in this particular conspiracy statute, the Supreme Court has held for a long time that defrauding, a conspiracy to defraud the U.S. has a broader meaning, and it also covers any scheme to interfere with or impede the lawful functions of the U.S. government by some kind of dishonest method. So you actually don't have to prove that the government lost any money or property, and it can apply if you just engaged in a scheme to thwart some lawful government process or government function. So a common type of charge it applies to is tax evasion, where people structure or try to hide their transactions in a way to avoid detection by the IRS. And that can be charged as a conspiracy to defraud the U.S., even if the government can't show they actually lost any money, because they're trying to thwart the lawful functions of the IRS. So in a campaign context, it's possible that if there's a dishonest and secret scheme to meddle with the U.S. election, since that's a kind of core government function, that you could charge that scheme as a conspiracy to defraud the U.S.
All right, and this seems like a very important point that I just want to make sure everybody understands. If it were proven that the Trump campaign did engage in a dishonest scheme to undermine the U.S. election, that would in itself be a crime. It's a crime to attempt to undermine an election. I'm going to ask for, you know, obviously we're speaking hypothetically here, and I'm going to ask for another one. There was a bunch of hacks. There was hacks of the Democratic National Committee. There was a hack of John Podesta's emails. Would the Trump campaign, would they face legal jeopardy if they were somehow involved in those hacks, if they asked the Russians to do those hacks but didn't hack them themselves?
Yeah, definitely. If they were involved to that degree, then we're talking another conspiracy, right? I talked earlier about conspiracy to commit an offense against the U.S., which is basically conspiring to commit any federal crime. There's a federal statute, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, that basically prohibits hacking. It has a lot of different ways you can violate that statute, but basically breaking into someone else's computer and stealing their information is a federal crime. So if the Trump campaign was involved in sort of, you know, encouraging that hacking or causing it to take place or things like that, then there's definitely a violation there. You know, or if it's also possible that if the hacking took place and it was already done and then the Trump campaign was contacted, then we could begin again be talking about other crimes like accessory after the fact or, aiding and abetting, you know, failing to report that offense and encouraging the Russians to use the stolen data, receiving stolen property. I mean, there's a lot of possibilities.
And when you say that there's a lot of possibilities, there was a piece not long ago, maybe the week before last, that appeared in Mother Jones, and they went and they interviewed a bunch of prosecutors, and I think they talked to some defense attorneys as well. And what their point that they made was that there is a very large book of criminal code, and prosecutors are able to start with a set of facts, and then they basically can get creative with how they charge people. And civil liberties advocates are often troubled by the latitude that they have to charge. Is that, can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's certainly a matter of often a matter of debate, sort of the breadth of the federal criminal code. Do we have too many criminal offenses? Things like that. I think the two key things to focus on. The first is it's really important to remember that we don't always want to leap to criminal remedies right away. I mean, criminal remedies have to be reserved for the most egregious kind of conduct. And so when these things pop up in the media and it's easy for people to start talking about prosecutions right away, there's a lot of sleazy, unethical, immoral stuff that goes on in politics and the world in general that isn't criminal and shouldn't be, right? So yeah. It's, you know, it's entirely possible that all of this is going to end up being, you know, politically awful, political malpractice and immoral or unethical or whatever you want to call it, but not a crime. And that's right. And absolutely possible. And it's way too early to say anything to the contrary. But you know, Bob Mueller is a top-notch lawyer, prosecutor, and he's put together a really good team. So I wouldn't have any concerns about prosecutors in the special counsel's office sort of going rogue and making up some creative offenses. I think they're going to do a good and thorough and professional job. If there aren't crimes here, they won't bring them. And if there are. I think part of your point, there are plenty of tools in the prosecutor's toolkit. So if there was criminal misconduct here, there are definitely going to be statutes that will apply. And this idea that's being floated around in some circles that, well, even if there was collusion, it's not criminal, so what's the big deal? I just don't think that's right at all. There are plenty of potential crimes. The only issue is, do they actually occur?
And as you say, he has put together really like kind of a prosecutorial legal dream team, investigative dream team, 15 top prosecutors and a total staff of, I believe I read this morning, it was up to 26. They finally moved into a building with secure facilities that allows them to interview people about classified information. It's a serious investigation, unlike what we've heard at times about the Senate and House investigations. Let me ask you one final question before I let you go. The president has broad powers to pardon people. He might be able to pardon himself. There's some debate among legal scholars. Right. We've talked about that in the past. But that's just for federal crimes. Can any of this be charged, do you think, at the state level by someone like Well, it took place in New York, so there's Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General.
I doubt that a state prosecutor could prosecute the president. I think there would be, you know, constitutional barriers to that. Whether any other state law crimes were violated, you know, theoretically, sure. I mean, yeah, we haven't heard a lot about that. If there was some interference with the election at the state level, you know, that, like we're talking about targeting particular states and trying to influence the election in those key states, potentially, sure, that could violate some state law, and state prosecutors could get interested in that. I guess that seems a little unlikely to me, but, I mean, it seems like this is going to be primarily played out at the federal level in the special counsel's office, and there's not going to be much need or incentive for the states to get involved, but theoretically, sure.
Okay, yeah. And by the way, folks, we haven't even talked about the potential of withholding information on an application for a security clearance, which is punishable by up to 5 years if it is proven intentional. I really want to thank you so much for joining us, Professor Eliason. It's been really enlightening.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Folks, check out the professor's piece. It's titled, Yes, Colluding with Russians to Interfere with the Election is a Crime. And you can find it at sidebarsblog.com. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Jill Filipovic.
First things first, I'ma say all the words inside my head. I'm fired up and tired of the way that things have been. Oh, ooh, the way that things have been. Oh, ooh. Second thing, second, don't you tell me what you think that I can be. I'm the one at the sail, I'm the master of my sea. Oh, I was broken from a young age, taking my soak into the masses, writing my poems for the few that look at me, took to me, shook at me, feeling me, singing from heartache, from the pain, taking my message from the veins, speaking my lesson from the brain, seeing the beauty through the...
Believe.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Jill Filipovic. Jill is a columnist for Cosmopolitan. She writes actually all over the place. In addition to that, she writes for the New York Times, or she's had pieces in the New York Times, and she's the author of a new book called The H-Spot, The Feminist Pursuit of Happiness. Jill, welcome back to the show. It's been a while.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. Now, I'm talking to you from Kenya. No, you're talking to me from Kenya. I'm in New York.
Right.
Can I just ask what you're doing down there?
Yeah, I'm here working. So, you know, most of the work that I do is about U.S. politics, but I also write quite a bit about human rights and reproductive health in sub-Saharan Africa. So I'm living here and focusing more on that area of my work.
And how has it been? What has the adjustment been like to be in Kenya? And where are you in Kenya?
I'm in Nairobi, so okay. I'm in the capital city. And it's great. Nairobi is beautiful. There's a ton of journalists here. It's a really dynamic, creative, rapidly changing city. So I'm loving it. I'm in no hurry to leave.
I want to visit. All right, so let's talk about the book. I thought it was a really good book, kind of a radical approach. That's why I invited Jill on. But in the interest of full disclosure, I should just say that we were colleagues for a short time several years ago. We're friendly acquaintances, and also the H Spot is a Nation book, and I'm a Nation contributor. So with all of that out of the way, I guess let's just start with the basic thesis here. We always talk about the fight for equality, right? That's like the basic premise of feminism. How is happiness a feminist issue? And why shouldn't women be miserable in the age of Donald Trump? I'm miserable.
Yeah, it's a good question. No, I mean, obviously, I'm a feminist. I believe in equality for men and women. And the fact that equality has been a central goal of the feminist movement, I think, is a really important one. But as I was, I mean, before I wrote the book, as I've been writing about women and feminism and gender for a pretty long time now, it really kind of struck me that one of the reasons we seem to be getting pretty inadequate results is that we're trying to make women equal to men in a system that was just not designed according to women's lives and according to our needs. It was very much designed in a way that suits the needs of a small subcategory of men. And so I think the ultimate goal of the feminist project has to be not just make us equal in this system that, frankly, I don't think we're ever going to be able to be equal in, but really think about, you know, if we got to be the ones to make policies, to design institutions, to structure our cultural norms, what would that look like? And, you know, how could we make a world that doesn't just make women more equal, but that actually addresses what it is that we want and what brings us happiness and health and life satisfaction?
I mean, to what degree do you think the system is actually kind of structured to make women unhappy? And I'll just put it this way. You're both told to lean in and to be ambitious and to have, you know, a career. Because it is 2017 and we've gotten that far. And then there is the basic realities of biological reproduction, and we don't have any like family leave policies.
Right. I mean, it's a total racket.
It's a racket.
I think, you know, I think our workplaces are some of the kind of most obvious examples of this. I mean, we operate as if it's still 1955 and most families are, you know, two parent married couples where the husband works full time and the wife stays home full time with the kids.
Right.
Very few American families actually look like that. But we haven't redeveloped a policy landscape that actually meets the needs of those families. Like you said, we have no parental leave. We don't have affordable daycare. You know, we still sort of see women and men as well, but people as kind of workers first and human beings with whole lives second. And there's no reason it has to be this way, right? Like, it's not as if God gifted all of these policies down to us from heaven. Like, we get to design them ourselves. And there are certainly ways that we can cater to the fact that, you know, A, there is this biological reality that women have babies. But you know, men have babies too. They're not typically carrying them and birthing them. But most men today do want to be involved in their children's lives, do have lives outside of work, and do also want to be considered kind of whole people and, you know, don't just identify themselves in terms of what their job is. And I think we can do a much better job promoting happiness, you know, for both men and women if we started to recognize that and made our workplaces more humane and more reflective of the fact that we are human beings in and out of work.
So, okay, let's talk about that. In the book, you talk about this unfinished feminism. You call for a public policy regime that promotes women's happiness. And beyond the very obvious, like, you know, so-called work-family balance policies, beyond that, what might it look like?
So, I mean, I would like a system that just kind of took the nuclear family mostly out of the equation, or at least stopped assuming that is kind of the pinnacle of happiness for most people. You know, the way that our nuclear families were kind of sold to us, you know, in the sort of height of them in the 1950s, was that, you know, this way of living, this kind of suburban, isolated, very kind of immediate family-centric model was going to make us all happier. We know now that it doesn't. What we know from the sort of building body of research on happiness and well-being is that connectivity and being social and having a lot of different and diverse social connections makes our lives better. So, I mean, to me, that speaks to better policies that, you know, enable shared housing, that enable urban living, that don't assume that the nuclear family model is the best model or that it is the only model that we live in. I think an example that I use in the book is single moms. So in the United States, single mothers have some of the worst outcomes of any developed nation. In our economic peer nations, single mothers face the same challenges. They make less money. Obviously, a single parent household is going to have less income coming in than a dual earner household. They tend to be less educated. They tend to be younger. All these kind of, you know, demographic factors are the same. But really only in the U.S. are single mothers this likely to live in abject poverty. And that is because our total lack of a social safety net and support systems. Obviously, that makes single mothers miserable. It's bad for their kids. It's bad for society. And it's a policy choice that we're making. Our economic peer countries make different choices. And women wind up a lot happier.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, I'm Joshua Holland. I'm speaking with Jill Filipovic about her new book, The H-Spot, The Feminist Pursuit of Happiness. You talk about this contradiction, and obviously you're not the first, but this pressure we put on girls to be sexy but not sexual, these contradictory messages we send. And it seems to me that this is an area where, I don't know, over the last 20 years or so, we've seen both progress and stasis and maybe even some regression in some areas. Like, it seems that at least in, I don't know how to put it, like, metropolitan or culturally liberal circles, there women are now allowed to a much greater degree than they were, again, just 20 years or so ago, to seek out sexual pleasure without a lot of stigma attached. And yet it seems that we're pretty much at the same place as we were in a lot of other ways. Can you just talk a little bit about where you see specific progress versus stasis? Or even regression?
Yeah. So I think in a lot of ways, of course, it's better. It's a better time to be a woman or a girl than ever before. Like you said, we have more opportunities. We have more freedoms. You know, and in the sexual realm, the advent of the birth control pill and safe and legal abortion has made pleasurable sex for women much easier to attain. And it's also made it a social norm. I mean, sex for recreation and not for procreation is, like, by far the most popular recreational activity in the U.S., right? So I bet if you tally up the hours people spend on it.
I thought it was watching TV, but I'll go with it.
Maybe watching TV beats it. But I'll bet it's more popular than, like, playing football.
Yes.
In any event, you know, it is at the very least one of the sort of more common things that we spend our leisure time doing. You know, but in the sort of more formal sectors, in our schools, in our churches, there still is a message that young girls get quite loud and clear that they are the gatekeepers to sex and that it's kind of up to them, not to decide, you know, when and how they have sex when they want to, but to make sure that, you know, boys aren't able to access sex.
Right.
You know, and it is kind of this idea that sex is this thing that women have and that men are trying to get, and kind of female pleasure is often totally taken out of that discourse. You know, we also have obviously intense sexualization of women in media, in advertising, in magazines. And those are a lot of really mixed signals that I think the message that girls and women get is that they both embody sex and that it is kind of their job to be sexually pleasing objects to men. And that can make having good sex, I think, much more complicated. So, you know, obviously it's great that we have this increasingly free sexual landscape. You know, but I still think we have quite a ways to go in terms of situating sex as something that for women is recreationable and recreationable is not a word, recreational and pleasure centric.
Yeah.
And not just about, you know, kind of performing, for men.
Right. I feel almost hackneyed asking this so, because it's so, I don't know, like gender studies 101, but isn't this a very middle to upper class thesis? I mean, it just seems to me that in the lower end of the economy, even though, of course, the burden of, you know, unremunerated childcare falls on women, I'm not sure if men have a ton of capacity to seek out happiness as opposed to subsistence, survival. And of course, that's in the context of the developed world. There are lots of people on planet Earth who are literally just scratching out to survive on a daily basis. Is that something you were aware of as you wrote this?
Yeah, definitely. That's absolutely true. And, you know, so one of the points that I make in the book is that one unique thing about the United States is that in our, you know, in the document that declares us as an independent nation, there is this promise that, you know, all men are not only created equal, but are imbued with the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, and we know that the Declaration of Independence, that group who were promised this pursuit of happiness was not all inclusive, right? It didn't
white
include
white property owners.
Exactly, white male property owners.
Yeah.
And that still is very much kind of who this universe is built around. So in the book, I mean, I interviewed a lot of women who are in very different circumstances than I am. And who live all over the country and who have a whole variety of life experiences and challenges. And one of the points I try and make is that, you know, again, with this kind of equality model of like making women equal to men, like you said, a lot of men aren't doing very well either. And right. I'm not sure that a lot of women kind of look around at the men in their lives and say like, well, I want to be equal to, you know, to this guy who also is living under, you know, constrained, crappy circumstances. The reason I focus on female happiness in the book is because female happiness kind of like helps like rise all boats. So when women are happy, their children tend to be happier, their husbands tend to be happier. Women are more sociable than men, so they have, you know, this kind of more outward looking way of approaching the world. And if you focus on what makes women happier, men actually tend to be less happy than women. And so if you increase women's happiness, it helps kind of like bring up the happiness of everyone around them, if that makes sense.
So you're saying a rising tide of happiness raises all boats.
Exactly. And that when you're thinking about like, right, like whose happiness to focus on.
Does this make you a neoliberal shill?
Oh, obviously.
Okay, all right. I just need to get that straight.
I mean, that's what Twitter tells me, so.
Twitter is antithetical to both men's and women's happiness, I believe. Now, I joked earlier about Trump's election, but it occurs to me that, so your book came out in early May, and I've written a book, so I know that you must have had at least like an early draft done before the election, right?
Yeah, I had almost a final draft done before the election.
Okay, so you had almost a final draft. I don't even know what to ask you about this. I'll make it an open-ended question. Just generally, how did this rather shocking outcome change your view of where women are, where feminism is? I mean, we elected this corrupt, confessed perpetrator of sexual assault instead of the, you know, email lady, and it... It certainly changed. I think it changed a lot of people's perspective. How did it change yours?
Yeah. So when I was writing the book,
what revisions did you make? Did you make revisions after that?
Yes, I had to.
Okay.
I wrote the book with this sort of sense that we were moving forward. You know, after 8 years of Obama, with Hillary as, you know, the kind of presumed successor, it really felt, you know, and then with kind of feminism also increasingly mainstreamed in pop culture, you know, Beyonce, just everywhere, it really, really felt like we were moving forward, and maybe not at, you know, as rapid a clip as I would have liked, but as though we were making progress. And so the kind of initial idea for the book was to frame, like, where are we going and what's next? And, you know, now that the feminist movement is really kind of moving forward, how do we start thinking about, you know, feminism now and our policy goals and our objectives, and also kind of how we frame the future of the movement? Obviously, when Donald Trump won, what felt like fairly swift forward trajectory hit a really, really big wall. And, you know, in both kind of the revisions to the book, but then also in just thinking about American society and, you know, everything that I felt like I had gotten wrong over the past 8 years, you know, I was really trying to consider, okay, so now that we have hit this big wall, how do we reorient? I think one thing that the right has done a really, really great job of is putting forward a very coherent and clear moral vision for what they want the world to look like. Yes. And it's a vision that, you know, we have an example of. It's this kind of 1950s post-war traditional family economic prosperity view. And, you know, we have the kind of cultural touch points that make that, I think, for a lot of people, really attractive. And I'm not sure that the left has been able to offer something quite that effective. And I think part of that is that there is kind of no golden age that we're pointing to, because as progressives, obviously, you want things to change and to get better. But I also think part of it is that we don't necessarily always craft our arguments in terms of kind of expansive moral ideas. And, you know, we may talk about things in terms of health or in terms of rights or in terms of equality, and those are all really great. But I don't know that, you know, we really frame them as, here's our big picture of what the world looks like, or what the world could look like and what we're trying to build. And so I tried to reframe the book kind of from that perspective. You know, so now we're newly on the defensive. How can we, you know, not just be kind of batting back every terrible thing this administration does, but, you know, we're going to have to do that sometimes, but how can we be both, you know, on defense and on offense with this kind of big picture moving us forward, to offer an alternative to what Trump and the Republican Party are trying to put on the table?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is very important to present things in moral terms. George Lakoff has been arguing this for as long as I've been paying attention to politics, you know, that the right has this cohesive moral framework for their obviously or often immoral policy preferences. And we have actually, you know, policies that benefit the greater good that we don't frame adequately in moral terms. It puts us behind the eight ball. Jill, I believe we're about out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I love the show, so it's a treat to be on.
Thank you so much. Folks, check out Jill's book. It's titled The H-Spot, The Feminist Pursuit of Happiness. It's available everywhere from Nation Books. But before we wrap things up this week, I feel I'd be remiss if we didn't at least touch on the Senate health care bill.
Alive. It's alive. It's alive.
Yes, it's very much alive, although with support hovering around 15%, it really shouldn't be. It is a monster, but a monster of their own creation. Republicans, they lied shamelessly about Obamacare for years. They told their base that it was worse than like New Coke or a planet-killing meteorite. And now they're caught between a rock and a hard place. They don't really want to pass a bill that would do this much political damage to their brand. I don't know if they also care about the real world damage. Maybe some do. But they have no choice but to try. They've painted themselves in this corner. Mitch McConnell shoved the bill to the right because, as the conventional wisdom go, moderates always cave. He has a pile of money to buy them off with various goodies. He's already put in tens of millions of dollars for Alaska to win over Lisa Murkowski, the so-called moderate. He included the so-called Cruz Amendment to win over Ted Cruz and perhaps Mike Lee. This allows insurers to sell crappy MIC insurance plans in any state where they sell real insurance. It doesn't sound that bad, but it would result in a disastrous adverse selection scenario where healthy people buy catastrophic coverage and leave only sick people in the sicker people in the full insurance pool. The premiums over in the regular market would just skyrocket and eventually price lots of people out of the pool. The nation's two largest insurance groups, Blue Cross Blue Shield and America's Health Insurance Plans, they represent, you know, most insurers. They wrote a rare joint letter to Congress this week that said, and I quote, "It is simply unworkable in any form and would undermine protections for those with pre-existing medical conditions, increase premiums, and lead to widespread terminations of coverage for people currently enrolled in the individual market." Sounds good, right? So Rand Paul and Susan Collins are both no's on proceeding to a vote. If McConnell loses one more, then it's game over, at least for this iteration. But the problem is that nobody wants to be that third senator. Earlier in the process, Lindsey Graham said that this bill will either get 50 votes or 35 votes because senators will abandon it in droves if they don't think it's going to pass. It's just nobody wants to be number three. The CBO score on this will be brutal, but here's the thing. Senate Republicans said they forgot to send over the text of the Cruz Amendment for the CBO to analyze. So whoopsie. And now they don't want to wait for the CBO to come up with a number. They're urging their caucus to vote on this piece of garbage that will fundamentally reshape a sixth of the economy. And they want to do it without a CBO score. They want to use some wingnutty analysis from Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price, from the Trump regime, from the honest people in the Trump regime. And I want to just stress that all of this is totally unprecedented and you have to keep up the heat. Call your senators, call them again, and then, you know, call your member of Congress because this could get through the Senate and go to the House for a vote. That is still a real possibility. And make no mistake, this bill is so immoral that it's shocking that a major party is pushing it, especially against the will of the public. I mean, 15% support. Again, they've painted themselves in this corner. So keep at it. Keep the heat on because they're getting a lot of pressure from the right. They're getting a lot of pressure from donors and the Heritage Foundation and, you know, all of these deep-pocketed groups that have a lot of money to give them are pushing these people relentlessly to vote for this bill. And the only thing that is stopping them or that has a chance of stopping them is the resistance. Anyway, I would like to thank Randall Eliason and Jill Filipovic. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. I actually think SoundCloud may not be around for much longer, so you might not want to subscribe there, but whatever. I'd also like to thank Digby, Crooks and Liars, and the Smirking Chimp for letting us park the show at their respective joints. And of course, I want to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.